Of the universe from the landscape multiverse, and by landscape I mean the real thing, I don't mean the double well potential. So this is work, it's a whole program, and this work started in 2004 when I, like many other people, were pondering the question, why did our universe have to start in such an incredibly special state with such a small entropy? And it was also the same time when the landscape of string theory was discovered and was being placed in very firm ground, and Leni Susskind coined it the landscape. So it was a prime time to try and do something different. Rather than worry about probability calculations of an equilibrium state and then say, well, this looks really unlikely, we thought that perhaps it's time that we shift our way of thinking. We shift the paradigm from symmetry breaking methods that had been the traditional methods then to a totally new framework, the multiverse. And the landscape of string theory, that discovery did help a lot in thinking along those terms for a few reasons. First of all, I could not understand how can we ask such a question, such a fundamental question, and at the same time probably a silly question, why did we start with this universe, without actually having a phase space of many possible initial conditions, many possible initial states. Only then the question, why did I start with this one rather than something else, makes sense. So that was part of the motivation. And of course, even 5 or 6 years ago, it was As many of my friends and colleagues politely put it, it was very radical, courageous or mad to talk about the multiverse, and even less to try and understand the birth of our universe within this framework of the landscape. So anyway, we stuck our guns to it. We took the landscape of string theory as being really good news, because any candidate of quantum gravity from which we could hope to get an answer to that question should have ended up predicting a multiverse. And that's not new in physics. Quantum mechanics does, inflation does. So the next step was, right, okay, now that we have some framework of thinking, how can we actually select the initial conditions of our universe without appealing to something we don't really understand or something equally confusing, without exchanging one confusing concept with another? So I proposed in 2004, and that's work done in two parts. One was done with my postdoc, then Archil Kovagice, that we allow the wave function of the universe to propagate on the landscape of string theory. At least we have a toolbox there by which we can do calculations and derive predictions. Soon we realized that that was not enough, as I'll show you in a minute. So in the next step of this program, of course, we needed to worry about the quantum to classical transition. You get a family of solutions from the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Each of those can, there is no reason why either one of them cannot correspond to a physical universe, but there was an ingredient missing, and that was, how does that initial wave packet from the landscape eventually give birth to a universe, a classical universe, that leads to the one we observe today? And the missing ingredient there was decoherence. And once we start talking about decoherence, one has to worry about the usual stuff, that whatever you choose as your observer that will watch and measure that system, that wave function solution, better not interfere too much in the process of measurement. It seemed that the long wavelengths, superhorizon wavelengths of massive fluctuations would do exactly that. So in that part of the program, and I'm going to be very schematic because in 25 minutes I can't describe 6 years' worth of work, but in that process, these superhorizon modes, the massive fluctuations, can backreact on the system and trigger two things. First, trigger decoherence, and second, leave possible imprints that I'll describe later that can test the theory. And then the third part of that program was, We have a toolbox, we know how to calculate, we have a theory, and we also are using the landscape structure that was derived in the paper by Douglas and Deneuve in 2004. And in order to include the coherence, not only are we fluctuating the metric and the moduli fields, but we are also including the internal structure of each vacua, of each landscape vacua. So can any of that stuff leave testable imprints on large-scale structure and in CMB? And the answer is yes, absolutely. Since I'm doing quantum mechanics on the landscape, by the unitarity condition, that information of the birth of the universe is not lost. It's present today. It could be small, but it's there. And we showed that in a series of papers with Rich Holman and Tomo Takahashi called The Avatars of the Landscape, and that was 2005-2006. So let me show very briefly the method. We have that V of phi, that potential of the moduli field phi, as the one described by Douglas and Deneuve. Then we do a Wheeler-DeWitt equation on a mini-superspace that is defined by the geometry scale factor A and the landscape moduli phi. However, doing just that gives the wrong answer. Now, I wish we had been smart enough to realize that before doing a calculation that involved random matrix theory and an n-body problem, but we weren't. We found out that if all you do is a Wheeler-DeWitt equation, you end up with the obvious answer that the wave function of the universe will be most probable at the lowest vacuum energy states. So then we included the fluctuations of the metric and the moduli fields, and the mini-superspace becomes an infinite dimension. So we have an n-body problem with 10 to the 500 landscape vacua. On top of that, we have a mini-superspace that is of infinite dimension. Algebraically, it is very complicated and challenging. On the bright side, condensed matter people have been there, have done that. They have studied those systems. When they study an electron going through a wire, they don't think of it as an electron going only through two neighbor atom sites. They actually do take the whole atom chain. And it turns out that in this case, the condensed matter analog that is closest, at least to this structure of the landscape that we use, the one by Douglas and Deneuve, it turns out that quantum dots are the system closest in analogy to this problem. So once you include fluctuations, then the Wheeler-DeWitt equation becomes a master equation. I'm just very briefly showing you the starting point of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, and once you have the solutions, of course, you can calculate the probability of distribution, and it turns out that the most probable universe in that picture would be the one that prefers zero energy vacua states, including fluctuations, and going from a Wheeler-DeWitt equation to a master equation by perturbing the metric and the moduli field phi. That back reaction changes the story quite a lot. Is this the... Anyway, I haven't got the pointer, don't worry. So the H naught is the zero order part of the Hamiltonian that belongs to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, and the sum over n, where n goes to infinity, of Hn is the correction terms that are derived from the fluctuations of the moduli and the metric. What you find after solving that problem, I mean, we have an equation. We know how to solve equations. It could be hard to do, but conceptually it's very straightforward. So once you solve that equation, you find out that the class of solutions of these wave functions of the universe that can give birth to a real physical universe, to one that grows with time, are the universes that start at very high vacuum energy states. And the reason for that, I'll try to explain it here in a schematic way. I mean, the calculation of the Euclidean action, including the corrections from the fluctuation modes, is horrendous. But you can think of the two dominant terms as being the one coming from the vacuum energy and the one as the sum of all the massive fluctuations. Think of those collectively as a black hole. So what you have is gravity in one side, represented by the dynamics of vacuum energy, and we know gravity is a negative heat capacity system. It will take that initial patch and try to blow it up to infinity. But then we have the back reaction of these matter modes that are trying to crunch into a black hole. So they are trying to do the opposite. The system is completely out of equilibrium. And depending which one wins in this tug of war, whether it is gravity or matter, will determine whether you can get a solution or not, whether you can get a physical universe out of it or not. So in that way of addressing the problem, in fact, the answer changes completely. The most probable way to start the universe is with high energy inflation. Anything with low energy will not be enough to survive the back reaction of matter. So there is a band of high energy solutions that will give rise to universes. And that band goes from the point where the exponent in that expression goes to zero. In other words, where the contribution to the action from the vacuum energy is equal and opposite to that of matter. So that's the borderline solution. That's the zero, strictly zero entropy solution. And the other extreme of that band is when you are looking at vacua with energies up to the string scale or the Planck scale, whatever the fundamental scale of the theory is. In that case, that back reaction term is so tiny that it barely even bends the dominant contribution, which is the vacuum energy. Once you reach that limit, you run into the Poincaré recurrence issues. But within that band of high energy inflationary patches, you do get the answer that they are the most probable ones. And that's a condition for survival. If the back reaction wins over this expansion induced by vacuum energy, you can't get a universe out of that wave function. So the surviving universes are only the ones in that band of high energy solutions. Okay, so far, now, if I'd given this talk a few years ago, I would have found a lot more resistance than now, but I think now we are all more at ease with ideas of multiverse and landscape and wave functions of the universe. So in terms of what I've described so far, it's worth noting that in this picture, inflation is not, high energy inflation is not a special state. In fact, it's the most probable way to get a universe. And the selection of the low entropy states is determined by this out of equilibrium dynamics of gravity versus matter. And the universe being born from a high energy state would automatically address the issue of the era of time. And I've not assumed classicality, I've addressed it by including decoherence. Now, I have been asked before, what does that mean in terms of the many worlds interpretation, since I'm putting a wave function on the landscape? And yes, quantum mechanics in this picture and the many worlds is embedded into the landscape multiverse. However, there is no splitting, because once you include this decoherence mechanism, the back reaction of fluctuations, once the universe becomes classical, there is no more splitting. Okay, now the interesting part, deriving predictions. We had to calculate that, and there are two parameters in this theory. One is a global parameter, that's the string scale or the Planck scale, and the other one is a local parameter, is the energy of each of those vacua states on the landscape. Having two parameters means that whatever I'll calculate will be given by the ratio of those two parameters. How did we do the calculation? Well, we have the wave function solution, and we can estimate from the cross terms of the density matrix, we can estimate how much that wave function is shifted away from its trajectory, from the classical path in the phase space. That shifting is translated into an energy shift and ultimately into a modification of Friedmann equation. And there was no phenomenology here. Everything has been derived by the usual quantum mechanics manner. And there is the correction to the Friedmann equation. So H there is the Hubble constant, V is the inflaton potential, and B is the energy of the vacua from the landscape. We can think of it as the scale at which supersymmetry breaks, if that's how we can get the vacua energies. But the interesting thing here is, first of all, we had to derive it. So even if I wanted to do something to fit this to new data that might be coming up in 10 years, I cannot change that expression. It's something that's been derived, so it can easily rule us out. The second important issue is it's highly non-local. It's super horizon size non-local correction. And what it really is exactly the quantum entanglement of our patch with everything else that originated from decoherence. It's just been traced forward from the birth of the universe to present times. Since we have two scales in this theory, as I mentioned, everything, every signature we expect will be given by the ratio of these two scales. So if B is the Susi breaking scale, the initial vacuum energy of the landscape, then we ended up with this constraint that for gut scale inflation, if V, the energy of inflation, is gut scale, then B is expected to be at least 10,000 times larger than the TeV scale. And as I'll mention in a minute, that has implications for LHC. Now, a bit more on the observation side. So we know what the corrections are, originating from this super horizon non-local entanglement, and we can directly through a Poisson equation translate those into modifications to the Newtonian potential of our universe, which is that delta phi term there. L1 in that expression is a very interesting scale. It's the coherence length of the universe, meaning that if you go that far in distance, if you go as far as L1, you will start to see the quantum nature of the universe. For gut, and it's a very complicated expression, but for gut scale inflation, if you wanted a number there, L1 would be about 1,000 horizon sizes, horizon radii. So it would be about 1,000 times the Hubble constant at present. So now I have all the tools I need to derive predictions, and those were done in 2005-2006. There is a series of features on the large-scale structure, that's the matter power spectrum, and on the CMB. The solid line is the usual conventional lambda CDM model, and the green and the blue lines are different values of that parameter B, of the vacuum energy from the landscape. So there seems to be a slight enhancement of power at small scales, and we'll know about those with Planck in about a year. However, one can, in principle, cook up another model and get similar signatures. So those are not enough to tell us whether there is any truth to this picture or not. Another interesting way to check for signatures is by cross-correlating cosmic shear with the CMB. And again, the solid line is the usual lambda CDM, but with Planck data, we might be able to see whether there are any spikes or not, as I have shown there. So let me wrap this up. What's the situation so far for these predictions made with Takahashi and Holman? Well, we predicted there will be a giant void of about 180 megaparsec, and that giant void was seen by WMAP as a cold spot, and a few months later by Rudnick et al. With radio astronomy. And there is a long story behind that void that it's a fun story, so I'll mention it in a minute. At the moment, For some time, it seemed that the void might not be there. Now it seems that the tabs have changed again and the void is there. But it was a very solid prediction. And we got lucky. It got tested 7 or 8 months after the prediction. The second prediction was the overall amplitude of fluctuations, sigma 8. At the time, the WMAP measurement said it should be about 1. And we said, well, because besides the inflationary perturbations, you have this second channel. There is a non-local entanglement that contributes to the Newtonian potential inside, then sigma 8 should be suppressed slightly, and we estimated it to be about 0.8. It turns out that a year later, WMAP and Sloan Digital Sky Survey agreed on that number. It's indeed 0.8. And I don't think that's been controversial at all. We have settled on that number. The most amazing part was the third prediction. That modification to the Newtonian potential does something very tricky. It tilts the potential of the universe. What that means is that structure now should slide relative to the expansion frame of the universe. An equivalent way to explain that is to say that CMB and expansion frames do not agree with each other. If inflation is all you have to the story, the two frames should identically agree with each other because both are seeded by the same thing, by the inflaton fluctuations. If you have a second source beside inflation, then you create this sliding of one frame relative to the other. That gives rise to a bulk flow of structure. That was dubbed, it was observed in 2008, and there's been a series of measurements and improvements and observations since then. It still carries on. But it was observed by the NASA team led by Kashlinsky at exactly the number we predicted, about 800 kilometers per second along the dipole. They have gone so far to scales up to a third of the horizon, and the effect is 3.5 to 4 sigma. With Planck data coming up in a year, the effect, and they are also increasing their X-ray cluster catalog, so in about a year, we'll know within 5 sigma whether it's there or not. At the moment, it seems that the prediction made in 2006 seems to be in perfect agreement with what was measured in 2008, even in terms of the magnitude of the flow. And it's amazing. I didn't know these people were measuring the flow. They had no idea of my work on the landscape of string theory, but there we are. The fourth prediction is the Susie breaking scale. If it is true that the vacua energy from which our wave function originated should be at about 10,000 times more than TeV, then Higgs will not be a fundamental particle. So we'll know about that when LHC comes along, which could be next year, or it could be next year plus 1 over epsilon, sorry for the typo there, where epsilon goes to 0. These are the kind of stunning predictions, but and there is the CMB fine-scale structure that I showed the graphs of. Those could probably be explained with other models, but these ones aren't. And the important thing is that we are talking about important stuff, and we can't take ourselves too seriously. I mean, there is a degree of humility that we all have when it comes to trying and addressing these questions. So I think being skeptic is very important, and I'd love to see that kind of skepticism applied, for example, to the dark flow or to all the other signatures. Let me give you an example about the void. When some of those predictions were tested, of course, there was a lot of media attention, and in one of the articles that was talking about this stuff, they interviewed Hira Naya. That was 2009, and in her words, she said, it is dangerous to hastily point at a cold spot in the sky and claim that it's a window into another universe who is dubious about all the highly theoretical multiverse, blah, blah. So, now a year later, after that void has been scrutinized, if I understood Hira Naya well, she's saying that even with superior statistics, superior data analysis, the void is there, at exactly where it was predicted. So that's good news, but I'm very glad that it was scrutinized. I hope someone will do the same about the dark flow, because that's an important signature, and a very unusual signature. Right, the significance. Why did the universe start in such an incredibly special state? There is a natural answer here, based on the out-of-equilibrium dynamics, and especially the role played by the gravitational degrees of freedom. It is those that make the selection of high-energy inflationary states. It is interesting because it makes a series of predictions and no postdictions. And the other interesting part is that all the parameters are so constrained that we just cannot tweak anything in those expressions and change the story if the data doesn't agree with us. So we can be ruled out very easily, and that's the part I like the most about this picture. On the other hand, because of this highly constrained system, whatever tests come along, the day that they are confirmed, they will also provide strong evidence for the multiverse, for this rich and vast structure that lies beyond our universe. And let me just be totally precise about it, about the landscape of string theory. 5 years ago, it would have been unthought of. But now, here we are. We are talking about observational tests and predictions of the landscape of string theory. It reminds me of a Schopenhauer saying, truth goes through 3 stages. In the first one, it is ridiculed. In the second one, it is strongly opposed. In the third one, becomes self-evident. So I'm sure there will be a meeting at some point in the future where we'll know whether things, these kind of stories will become self-evident or not. Thank you.
So just a question regarding the cold spot. I think what Hiranya found is evidence that there is indeed something that's anomalous at some level in the CMB.
There's a cold spot. Are you referring to the void?
Well, I'm referring to the cold spot. So
yeah,
the question
okay.
is whether the origin of that cold spot is a void, or mm-hmm. whether the origin is a cold spot in the primordial temperature distribution or something else.
Yeah.
And as far as I understand, the evidence is pretty strong that it's not from a void. There was
what
at some point. Sorry?
What is it? I don't know this story.
So there was a claim at some point that...
Yeah, I know, but now what was the recent claim? I haven't followed the story.
So it's been reanalyzed. Basically, people looked at large-scale structure data and found no evidence for a void.
But is the cold spot there?
The cold spot is there,
okay,
but there's
but
no evidence
not
for there
void.
Being a void in structure that would account for
Do
it.
Do you know what it is?
Well, no one knows for sure, but...
Oh, nobody knows. Okay.
If it's not a void, it's something that's there on the last scattering surface, presumably.
So there is a cold spot. We all agree with that. We just don't know whether it's a void or not. Is that fair enough?
There's no evidence for there being any void in large-scale structure. So
right. So but there is a cold spot.
But there is a cold spot, right.
Right. Okay.
Yes.
So there is a cold spot, but we don't know if it's a void or not. Okay. Well. I'm happy with that.
So where does the measure problem show up in your calculation?
I don't have a measure problem.
So that sounds like big news.
I don't have any infinities here. It's just quantum mechanics. You are told what the potential is from the landscape people, and you have a potential with hills and valleys. You allow a wave function to go through there, and then you include the fluctuations in order to address the coherence. Everything is finite. There is no measure problem.
So you don't have eternal...
Only a subset survives.
So I just want to finish. So you don't have eternal inflation? You predict no eternal inflation in the landscape?
No. In fact, thank you for asking that question, because that's something that I have been concerned about. I mean, in this case, the way the landscape is populated is wave function of the universe. And what happens is Anderson localization. Basically, as the wave function scatters through so many hills and valleys, you'll get reflection transmission. So it's just pure quantum mechanics. You'll have all these phases adding up to either instructive or constructive or destructive interference. That's how localization occurs. I didn't show that. It was Anderson who showed that. Anyway, but when it comes to eternal inflation, I'm very confused. I don't see. My view is that we worry about how inflation started and why it started at high energies. But once you have got inflation, and if you believe that is eternal, I don't understand why you need the landscape at all. I mean, eternal inflation makes
sense. But I was asking the other question. Most people who study the landscape think there's eternal inflation all over the place. But somehow
But eternal inflation makes its own multiverse. I have not seen, and maybe I haven't kept up to date, perhaps someone knows, but I have not seen a single example where someone showed how you get the eternal inflation pockets to run and occupy a vacuum of the landscape. I think eternal inflation just makes its own landscape. I don't see why the moment something pops here, it will go and take a vacuum of the landscape. I don't see why that's necessary. At least nobody has shown that yet.
Well, I think it's important to relate this to
absolutely.
The
other absolutely. So that is work that needs to be done.
And measure problems.
Yeah, I completely agree. And if I can add something to that, Andy, it is very important that whoever will do that, when it's done, it is really studied as an n-body problem. We know what the right physics is that we need to do. It cannot be oversimplified to a two-body problem. You are not going to get Coleman de Lucia instantons in an infinite lattice. You'll just get a very different story. You'll get all this multiple scattering that I was talking about and quantum effects like interference and stuff like that and localization. You don't get instantons. Story changes totally, but nobody has done that work as far as I know. It's very interesting. It's very important. But nobody has done it.
Thank you very much, Laura.
Thanks.